WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. The GOP presidential contenders, who are not Donald Trump, met to debate and talk over each other last night. Congress is looking into whether Tony Fauci colluded with the CIA on the COVID origins narrative. And Chase Bank just settled a lawsuit with the Virgin Islands over allegations that it facilitated and benefited from sex trafficking by its longtime customer, Jeffrey Epstein. Investigative journalist William F. Jasper is going to fill us in on what that means. But first, last night, while the GOP also-rans were debating, Donald Trump was in Michigan speaking to a raucous crowd of hundreds of auto workers and other supporters, with thousands more outside. Trump delivered his speech at Drake Enterprises, an auto parts supplier near Detroit. Many in the crowd held up signs that said, "Union members for Trump." Let's listen to some highlights.
To the welders, assembly line workers, machine operators, forklift drivers, pipe fitters, tool and die makers, mechanics, electricians, technicians, and journeymen, we love being with you, and we love being with you right in your environment. You built this country, you love this country, and you are the ones that make our country run. You know that, right? But it was the men and women who got every single day, they got up and came back home with grease on their hands, and they were the ones that paid the price. They paid a big, big price. The only time Joe Biden has ever gotten his hands dirty is when he's taking cash from foreign countries, which is quite often, actually. It's quite often. Based on what we're seeing, it's much more often than anyone would have thought. But can you imagine an unannounced raid on his many homes? He would have made Senator Menendez look like a baby. To the striking workers, I support you in your goal of fair wages and greater stability, and I truly hope you get a fair deal for yourselves and your families. But if your union leaders will not demand that Crooked Joe repeal his electric vehicle mandate immediately, then it doesn't matter what hourly wage you get. It just doesn't make a damn bit of difference, because in 2 to 3 years, you will not have one job in this state. And you've seen it happen before. You've seen what happened where massive percentages of your industry went to other countries like Mexico, like China, like South Korea, like Japan. In other words, your current negotiations don't mean as much as you think. I mean, I watch you out there with the pickets, but I don't think you're picketing for the right thing. Because, you know, when Biden came here yesterday, they only had 11 people. I'll bet you we have 10,000 people standing outside. Right? I think we do.
Trump's massive lead in the polls only seems to be getting wider every time Democratic operatives masquerading as lawyers and judges indict him. And speaking of lawfare, a New York judge is now trying to use the weaponized legal system to strip Trump of his assets. Manhattan Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron, a Democrat, issued a ruling ordering that business certificates of all Trump-owned New York-based businesses be revoked. Engoron also ordered that a third party seize all assets and distribute them however the court sees fit. He did this without a trial or jury. In the 35-page ruling, the alleged judge accused Trump of fraud by overvaluing assets, including his Florida Mar-a-Lago estate. As the conservative treehouse explained, this is John Galt-level government targeting. A New York State judge has arbitrarily ruled that President Trump overvalued his real estate holdings in New York, which means he paid too much in taxes in order to secure financing and loans. All the banks and lenders did their own due diligence on the financing. All operational loans and business loans were paid back. There were no defaults or banking interests adversely impacted. There are no victims of what the state calls fraud, yet the judge is ruling that the Trump Organization must dissolve all business interests in the state and exit within 10 days. In response, Trump called the judge deranged, and he said that we are rapidly becoming a communist country. Join me to discuss today's stories as executive senior editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paul. Is there anything to discuss? I mean, pretty much Trump said it all right there in his inimitable way.
Steve, has anything comparable to this happen as far as like what this judge is ordering? Like we had mentioned, there's no trial, no jury or anything like that. He just decided this. Is this common? Has this happened before?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it happens a lot. In sub-Saharan Africa, in Central America, in India, in Southeast Asia, in Communist China. Absolutely. Very frequent occurrence.
Well, that's not...
Need I say more?
Reassuring. Okay.
But I know that to the spirit of your question, nothing remotely similar to this has ever transpired in American history.
Where do you see this going? He's going to appeal. I mean, is it official yet?
Well, sure. Yes. His lawyers are appealing. They don't have very long. I mean, the judge, this is the most naked power grab yet. And that's saying something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's. I don't know how it's possible to be more naked, but in any case, if it is, that's what we have here.
Yeah.
And the judge, in effect, has said, I'm taking your stuff. There's no trial. There's no case. As the commentary noted from the conservativetree.com, mm-hmm. I think it was, the author of that article, who writes under a pseudonym, I don't know who it is, but anyway, pointed out that there's no victim here.
Yeah,
that the banks all did due diligence, all the loans were paid back, everything was cool. In other words, it was a series of private business transactions. And moreover, because of his alleged inflating the values of his assets, he paid more taxes.
Yeah, I noticed
that. But all of that aside, it's false on the face of it. In particular, with reference, I don't know about all the New York assets, but the Mar-a-Lago property, which is also being targeted, even though it's not in New York
State. How can they do that?
Because it's part of, you know, all the Trump family corporations. They're trying to take Mar-a-Lago, too. They want to divest him of everything that he can use to continue his improbable presidential run. Okay, because the first time he was able to get elected without being beholden to the usual crew of D.C. lobbyists and other shady characters, because he was able to finance his entire
campaign.
Which
is what's happening now.
Which
obviously
is happening again. And so they figure, well, if they can't destroy him by locking him up, they can destroy him by taking his stuff. So this is legalized thievery on an unprecedented scale, targeting one particular individual. Okay, now, It's being claimed that the Mar-a-Lago estate is vastly overvalued, and that's simply not true. I mean, many smaller estates surrounding Mar-a-Lago and that same—
Are valued
proportionally more, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars. And so for him to claim that Mar-a-Lago is worth $30, $40 million, you know, I mean—
This is crazy.
Yeah, and also valuations, for anyone who understands economics, valuations are ultimately subjective. I mean, they rely to some extent on external indicators, on circumstance, and so forth and so on. But they ultimately, something is worth what a person is willing to pay for it.
I found it ironic. I saw a clip of Letitia James talking about this, and she's the prosecutor for it, right?
And she has sued him, I don't know, several hundred times. She's basically—
Oh, is that what it is? I didn't
yeah,
know
she's
that.
Gone after him again and again and again ever since he was elected to office the first time.
Yeah. The irony is that what she said, and obviously this is something the left says quite often, is that no one is above the law. That's so rich, isn't it? Considering this is what the left is. It is above the law. We have about a minute here. Any comments on what Trump said to the auto workers there? I found that interesting that he was brave enough. I don't know if that term is too strong to tell him, you're picketing for the wrong thing. Everyone but them apparently knows, or maybe they do know, obviously.
Well, I think a lot of them do understand that. And, you know, again, the contrast between his rapturous reception and the very tepid reception that Biden received there the previous
day. By the 11
day.
People?
Yeah, and there may have been more than 11 people, but most of them were union officials. But I think it bears pointing out that the place where that's Drake Automotive, whatever the name of the company was that makes parts, is non-union.
Oh.
So there were a lot of union people there, but the company itself, I think, was strategically chosen. And, you know, clearly he's sympathetic with unions in some sense, collective bargaining, but he's saying, and I would agree with them, we don't have time to really elaborate,
that
their hearts are in the right place, but they're picketing for the wrong reason. They're striking for the wrong reason.
Right.
They're fixing blame to the wrong parties.
Yes, and
at least the leadership is that, Sean Fain and those people.
And that's going to be a common theme in the GOP debate too. We're going to be right back to look at that. So up next, we are going to look at last night's GOP debate. and the congressional probe into Fauci's alleged collaboration with the CIA on the origins of COVID.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
While Trump was speaking to auto workers in Michigan, the other seven Republican presidential contenders debated at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. Not surprisingly, they went after the elephant not in the room.
And you know who else is missing in action? Donald Trump is missing in action. He should be on this stage tonight. He owes it to you to defend his record, where they added $7.8 trillion to the debt. That set the stage for the inflation that we have now.
And I want to look at that camera right now and tell you, Donald, I know you're watching. You can't help yourself. I know you're watching, okay? And you're not here tonight, not because of polls and not because of your indictments. You're not here tonight because you're afraid of being on the stage and defending your record. You're ducking these things. And let me tell you what's going to happen. You keep doing that, no one up here is going to call you Donald Trump anymore. We're going to call you Donald Duck.
Trump's challengers, if you can call him that, did agree with him on the real reasons auto workers are feeling the financial pain. Here's Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley.
You know what? If I was giving advice to those workers, I would say go picket in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. That's really where the protest needs to be. Disastrous economic policies that have driven up prices, that have driven up interest rates and mortgage rates. At the same time, wages remaining stagnant. What we need is to deliver economic growth in this country. Unlock American energy. Drill, frack, burn coal, embrace nuclear energy. Put people back to work by no longer paying them more money to stay at home. Stabilize the U.S. dollar itself and rescind a majority of those unconstitutional federal regulations that are hampering our economy. That is how we unleash American exceptionalism.
But why are those workers actually there? It's because of all of the spending that he has pushed through in the economy that's raised the inflation. So when you look at the fact that we are paying higher gas prices, higher grocery prices, $7,000 more a year for families, what we need to do is I came out with an economic plan, eliminate the gas and diesel tax so that they have more money in their pocket. Let's focus on going after middle America and cutting taxes for middle America and collapsing those brackets. Let's get rid of unfair distortions like the state and local tax that they give to wealthy people in blue states and not and paid by red states. And let's make sure we make the small business taxes permanent.
The candidates also discussed the border crisis. Here's Nikki Haley echoing the sentiment of pretty much everyone on stage.
When Joe Biden waved the green flag, it told everybody to come. And now we've seen 6 million people cross the border. We've had more fentanyl that have killed Americans in the Iraq, Vietnam, or Afghanistan wars combined. We need to make sure that we are a country of laws. The second we stop being a country of laws, we give up everything this country was founded on. So we have to secure the border. The way we do that is, first of all, defund sanctuary cities. You see what's happening in Philadelphia right now. It's gotta stop. We need to make sure we put 25,000 more Border Patrol and ICE agents on the ground and let them do their job. I spent 400 miles down that border, and I'm telling you, Border Patrol agents aren't allowed to do their job. Let's go back to Remain in Mexico policy. Instead of catch and release, let's go to catch and deport.
The contenders discussed lots of other critical issues, albeit many times over each other. They talked about China, crime and officer retention, and even child care. I'm going to bring Steve back in here. We only got a little time to discuss this one.
Steve, I never left, Paul. I was here the whole time listening to you. Just making that clear.
Do you Anything stick out to you? It seems like the only thing they really disagreed on was Ukraine aid. They had various different positions on that. Yeah. The ones who are rhinos had the positions you would expect, that we need to keep giving. And I think it was just DeSantis and Ramaswamy who opposed aid. Anything you make of that we just listened to?
There weren't any real surprises. These are all also-rans. At this point, you know, their denunciations of Trump ring pretty hollow, given mm-hmm. his immense lead in the polls. And it's easy to see why, because with the half exception of Vivek Ramaswamy, who sometimes sounds Trumpian when he wants to, although he doesn't look Trumpian. I think we remarked with they both have interesting coiffures, so there's that. But aside from that, you know, he does sound like a younger, more energetic Trumpling. So there is that.
Yeah.
But the rest of them are pretty much serving up the same bromides that we have heard literally for decades, and that may sound cruel, because you know a lot of what they're saying is I think right-minded. The problem mm-hmm. is they no longer have credibility. Because we've been hearing this since at least the Reagan era. You know, we need to do something about this. Oh, look at all these social problems. And, you know, we need to fix this and that. And then they never do.
Yeah.
And so the perception, of course, which I think is somewhat justified, is that the only person with a tinker's chance in a hot place of actually following up on some of these, you know, shaking up the system is Trump.
Who has shaken up the system, that's for sure. Let's look at our next story. So did Fauci collude with the CIA to bolster the COVID lab leak theory? On Tuesday, Ohio Representative Brad Winstrup, who leads the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic, sent a letter to the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services asking for any existing documentation of Fauci communicating with the CIA, especially during 2020. In his letter, Winstrup wrote, "According to information gathered by the Select Subcommittee, Dr. Anthony Fauci, then director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, played a role in the Central Intelligence Agency's review of the origins of COVID-19. The information provided suggests that Dr. Fauci was escorted into CIA headquarters without a record of entry and participated in the analysis to influence the agency's review." Winstrup said that Fauci's questionable off-the-books visit to the CIA comes on the heels of recent whistleblower accounts suggesting that the agency may have skewed its own investigation of COVID origins by bribing 6 analysts to reach inconclusive results. Last year, we learned that Fauci prompted the key scientific paper that disproved the lab leak theory, published on March 17, 2020 in Nature Medicine and written by 5 renowned evolutionary biologists. The paper titled The Proximal Origin of SARS-CoV-2 played a crucial early role in shaping the pandemic narrative and policies. In February, reports issued by the Department of Energy and the FBI claimed that the virus came from a lab leak. All right, Steve, this seems like a pretty complicated story. So what if they find that Fauci visited with the CIA? What I didn't mention in there is the CIA gave Newsweek a statement where they're pretty much saying it's routine for us to engage with experts inside the government. And I imagine that's so. So what do you make of this?
Well, first of all, that's true. The only thing that, you know, provisionally would be shocking about this story would be if it were proven that the CIA wasn't involved, because they have their fingers in every mess of pottage in Washington, particularly anything that has to do with, you know, international affairs. This has been the case for decades. They run very calculated disinformation programs with respect to the press. That was documented way back in the 1970s and earlier, that they deliberately, you know, make calculated leaks and they massage the narrative all the time to get the press to say things. I mean, they are incredibly sophisticated, diabolical, but sophisticated.
Right.
And you have to hand that to them.
Well, obviously, it seems like what they're trying to get at here is that the CIA colluded with the CDC or NIH to fabricate the slab leak theory. And I think what they're trying to get to, I would imagine, is why. Because the deeper you go in there, I imagine you're going to find that collaboration, and then we're going to start tying the Wuhan lab, gain of function, and all sorts of perhaps even illegal activities. I'm guessing that's where this is going.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, the problem with using the word illegal is that we're kind of on virgin soil, as far illegally speaking, where the COVID pandemic is concerned, because lots, as we were discussing before the show, I mean, lots and lots of undoubtedly immoral, amoral, and dastardly deeds were committed by Fauci and many others in the ensuing cover-up and everything else. The question is what to do about it, because, you know, the standard for actual legal action in Washington, D.C. is remarkably low. There are whole, you know, areas of illicit, debauched, and otherwise immoral human behavior that goes unpunished routinely in D.C. And this may end up being one, just another example, unfortunately.
Right. And there's plenty to indicate that the CIA has gone rogue a while ago, and nothing's going to be
surprising. They've never not been rogue, I think.
Thanks, Steve. Well, after this, investigative journalist Bill Jasper joins us to analyze the Epstein-related Chase settlement.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
On Tuesday, J.P. Morgan Chase agreed to a $75 million settlement with the Virgin Islands, which alleged that the massive international bank facilitated and benefited from sex trafficking of young women by its longtime customer, Jeffrey Epstein. The New American's investigative journalist and senior editor, William Bill F. Jasper, has been following this very closely. So we're going to bring him in to fill us in on what this means. Hey, Bill.
Good morning.
Hey, like I said, I know you've been following this. We've had, we've even done segments on this as it was playing out. What is the most significant implication about this settlement?
Well, you know, it's a quite a large settlement, and that I'm sure has gotten a lot of people's attention. But to me, I kind of expected this to happen in the worst case, because Chase is the largest bank capitalized in the United States, public bank. And they've been through this rodeo a number of times in the past, as we've reported, on many different felonious charges. And they have paid out billions of dollars over the years, as we've detailed, on all kinds of skullduggery that the bank has been involved in. And still, through all of that, Jamie Dimon, the globalist head of the bank, CEO, has been given a thumbs up by the board of directors. So they are willing to fight and use all of the means at their disposal, which are considerable: political pressure, financial pressure, etc. And so if they end up paying, as some of the reports say, as much as $365 million or more, that is what they would consider the price of doing business.
And wait. So go back to that number. How is that? Because is that out in addition to the $75 million, or are we missing something?
Yeah. So they already had to pay $290 million. Out in this. There are several cases that are involved here with various victims, and there is and then there is are the criminal charges. And so when the Virgin Islands brought this most recent case, it looked like this might be the most promising way to actually force out many of the documents and to actually bring, hopefully, criminal charges against Chase and its leaders, because in the past they try to just buy off the victims, and in most cases the victims have been through quite a bit, and a lot of them just want to settle and get on with their lives, and so they know that they can wait this out and pay off the victims. And so there are some very interesting things that have entered into this, however, that could make it more difficult for Chase, which we can get into. One of the things which I don't think has been mentioned in most media accounts is that a former FBI forensic accounting specialist has come forward, and he actually, we have an affidavit from this case, which for some reason was not sealed. Most of the documents have been sealed. And he says that not only was Chase involved for much longer than they have publicly stated, but that they also tried to impede the investigation.
So when he says involved, does that mean essentially facilitating this? They knew what Epstein was doing, and in a way they turned a blind eye, but at the same time they played the bank. They were the bank for these transactions, right?
Absolutely. And they played the innocent, gee, we didn't know that it was that this was happening. If it did, we certainly would have stopped it. I mean, they made all kinds of statements like that through various of their officials. But as we pointed out in previous articles, their own internal emails and audit reports showed that they had some of their own people had issued SARs, suspicious activity reports, on Epstein, going back before his arrest and conviction in Florida. And then afterwards, of course, that those activities with Chase continued after he was convicted. And as we pointed out, not only were they flagging these activities, but they mentioned Jamie Dimon in particular in them, showing that this will have to be cleared by Jamie Dimon. So it's still possible that we may see some real justice in this.
How would that be? So basically this dashes significant hopes that we had of more of this coming to light, at least in this respect. But now you're saying there may still be a chance of justice. How was that? How would that come about?
Well, my understanding of the case is that there are still outstanding cases, and those cases maybe will be able to use whatever public documents they are able to get from this current case.
Now, you had okay, go on, Bayo. I'm sorry. Go on.
What has probably is most interesting to me and should be to the wider American public is that this tends to confirm the longstanding belief of many Epstein observers that he was an intelligence asset, that he was being protected by America's deep state intelligence community because he was providing a service to them as well as to the Israeli intelligence. We wrote about that previously. Ari Ben-Menashe, former Mossad agent, who said that he was a handler for Jeffrey Epstein, as well as for Ghislaine Maxwell, his confederate in this, and going back decades, her father before her, Robert Maxwell, who was a very mysterious, high-flying financier, media mogul, and intelligence asset. So that is really gets more to what I believe is the crux of the matter and why Jeffrey Epstein had such access to so many important circles of power and why he was protected. You know, when he was first prosecuted in Florida, he got his sweetheart deal. And the prosecutor then, the U.S. prosecutor, Alex Acosta, said that, well, he was told by his superiors, presumably in the Department of Justice, that he had to drop the case against against Epstein because he was with intelligence. In other words, this is above your pay grade. This is a national security matter. The CIA or DIA or NSA or whoever he's working for is protecting him. So you're not supposed to do anything with him.
Bill, we have about 30, 45 seconds. I heard that, I don't know, a commentary that basically there is actually no documentation of Epstein even like trading, finance trading. Do you know if that's true? Because
correct. Right. He has no background in any of that. So I believe Eric Weinstein, the physicist, mathematician, podcaster, a very bright guy.
That's where I heard
knew
it from.
Epstein. He said that he believes that Epstein was an intelligence construct.
Yes.
And I think that's right.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for looking into this. And keep it up, because we're going to have you back. We're going to follow this, unlike the mainstream media. Well, that's it for our news segment today, folks. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure you get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Next up, The New American's Alex Newman interviews Dark Eon author and transhumanist expert Joe Allen about the transhumanist war against humanity and what can be done about it. Let's watch.
Welcome, everybody, to Conversations That Matter. I am your host, Alex Newman. We have a very special guest joining us today. There's just so much to go through here, folks. And I've been sounding the alarm about transhumanism for years. It's like the biggest story that, unfortunately, has not really been widely talked about by the American people yet. But Joe Allen, an extraordinary individual. He does so much. He's actually working with Steve Bannon. He's got a new book out dealing with exactly this subject. It's called Dark Eon, The Transhumanist War Against Humanity. Truly critical reading here. Welcome to the program, Joe. Thank you very much for joining us. I want to start with the COVID and kind of the reemergence of this hysteria. You've got a chapter in your book about the pandemic as an initiation ritual. It seems like they're coming back with this, but what's the nexus between the COVID hysteria that we saw starting in 2020 and the advancement of these technologies and this transhumanist agenda? And what does that mean now that they're coming back with this stuff?
I think in the same way that 9/11 represented a massive shift in how technology was understood and deployed in regard to digital surveillance in a totally digitized society, what you saw during COVID, you had many of the similar technologies in regards to using sensors all over the society. They're basically ubiquitous to track people's movements, to track people's contacts, to identify social networks, all the things that surveillance have been used covertly for really since these algorithms were invented. You now, like suddenly 2.5-3 years ago, you had a mass push for everyone to submit to surveillance, very, very intimate surveillance going into the body itself, and not just as an imposition for some 50%, some half of the U.S. population. This was invited. It was embraced. So you had the mass digitization. You had, of course, e-learning. Suddenly that was the norm. I mean, there's nothing more important than the impacts of these technologies on children, because they are the ones who are going to be driving the future forward. And suddenly you had, if not every child, most children in the nation who were suddenly turning to their devices as an instructor. Suddenly the entire process of education was intimately wrapped up in this human machine interface. Now, in the wake of all that, you've got Bill Gates or Khan Academy who are talking about integrating GPT technology, a large language model, into the educational norms around the country, but also, of course, around the world. Maybe most importantly, because of the immediate and visceral effect of it, you suddenly had the imposition of a gene-based injection that was openly experimental, that immediately showed signs of injury and danger, and certainly a failure to effectively do what it was supposed to do, which was to stop the virus. And so it was an amazing moment, because the entire world underwent a psychological shift in which technology would save them from the hell that was being created around them by technocrats. And the way out of that hell, the way out of that ritual chamber, not unlike an archaic initiation rite, was to accept a dramatic invasive technology, to accept foreign DNA into your RNA, a foreign genetic code into your body, even as you could see with your own eyes that it wasn't working and was hurting people. So I think that was the beginning. They were just putting the tip in. And from there, it's just going to ramp up and ramp up. Who knows what the next crisis will be? Who knows what the source of the next crisis will be? But over and over again in American history, you see the same process. Whenever there's a crisis, those who want power or who are already in power will either try to gain power or consolidate the power they already have. And with the open declarations of the worldview, the kind of future they want human beings to live in, one can assume that those agendas will be pushed forward again and again and again. I suspect that Tucker Carlson is correct. Whether it's a direct hot war with Russia or China or just major American military involvement, I suspect that will be the next justification for even more invasive mass surveillance and even more draconian punishments for wrongthink.
Yeah, it's truly amazing what we're seeing here. Klaus Schwab, in his book on the Fourth Industrial Revolution, says at some point we may have to mandate these kinds of technologies like brain scans for everybody to determine whether they're national security risks. We've got people like Yuval Noah Harari saying that the pandemic was the first time we all accepted this ubiquitous surveillance that even is going to go under the skin. Before we went on air, you mentioned something really important that I want to emphasize for folks, and that was having to do with this Robux or Roblox, whatever. I don't even know all about it. I know my kids hear about it all the time. I know it's a really big thing with kids. You said they just integrated AI into it. You know, one of the big things that we saw during the pandemic was as all the education moved online, suddenly they're gathering all this data. Suddenly children are interacting constantly with machines and with technology. Talk a little bit about this thing that you just mentioned with the integration of the AI into the children's kind of gaming platform, and also how they're preparing children to live in this weird techno transhumanist future.
you know, these ideas are much better. All these are imaginations of the future, and they very readily capture the imagination of people who are imaginative. But most adults, you'll notice, if you try to explain to them that literally you have a conspiracy to bring science fiction into reality, they shrug it off. They don't see it. It's fairly invisible to them, even with the direct indications. With children are just, they're open, right? They absorb and readily take these fantastic voyages into the future. And that's healthy. That's good. The problem I see is that they're being herded much more than informed or inspired. So in the case of, and this is just one of many, many cases, in the case of Roblox, what you see is Roblox, of course, is a platform, it's a gaming platform. They really are, as far as metaverse companies, they're probably the most successful, not just because of virtual reality. I mean, the metaverse is not meta, obviously. And the metaverse, it's just the idea of having a virtual world that exists in parallel to society, to the physical world. And Roblox really provides a platform for that, including virtual reality. But their new, it's the AI assistant, it's the Roblox AI assistant. It's integrated, it will be integrated into the system. And so therefore you have roughly 200 million people, and among which over 40% are under the age of 13. And what it does is it allows a person to create a virtual world with verbal commands. At this point, typed, soon to be spoken. Mark Zuckerberg is working on something very similar for Meta. In fact, a number of these companies are working on something very similar. It may seem like, okay, what's the big deal? It's SimCity, right? Didn't everybody loves SimCity? But I think it's the degree of immersion, it's the degree of significance that's put on this virtual persona that these children embody. And then in the case of the AI assistant, you now have they're basically being trained to learn to kind of speak to the machine and understand that the machine will grant wishes. It's not that different from those of us who sat around watching Saturday morning cartoons and eating, you know, crummy breakfast cereals we saw on the commercials. But it is very much an acceleration of that into something that, as you know, the transhumanist dream will be a very tight human AI symbiosis, so that the human mind is very much like the AI and vice versa. And that relationship becomes not just desirable, but ultimately necessary.
I want to talk about the singularity. I think this is a term that probably not one in a thousand Americans would even be familiar with, and yet it is so monumentally important. It's going to affect every single one of us and every single one of our children in the decades to come, maybe even sooner than that. Let's start with the 50,000-foot view. What is singularity? What does it mean? What does the future look like when we arrive there, assuming we do?
The singularity as a concept was really it was really made concrete by Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil, top R&D director at Google now. Ray Kurzweil had a vision of the future in which Moore's Law, the doubling of computing power every 18 months to 2 years, would continue. And so therefore, in computing and in a wide range of different technologies, you would see a gradual acceleration in their efficiency, in their effectiveness, in their complexity. And so going on that assumption, looking at the history and the momentum and playing it forward into the future, he's probably too specific. I think his specificity is a handicap, but it's a very good way of understanding how transhumanists envision the future, because they have a very articulate vision of the future, whereas most of us are looking to next week or maybe at the best next year. And so what Kurzweil was describing is the total fusion of human beings with technology. He talked about it in terms of robotics, nanotechnology, and genomics. Artificial intelligence just being a subset of robotics. It's a robotic brain, so to speak. So his idea was that the artificial intelligence would become so complex as to be out of human control. Humans would not be able to comprehend it. They would not be able to do anything but fuse with it in order to be relevant in the future. His is one of many visions. There are transhumanists who don't believe that's the case. They think it's more gradual. There's a transhumanist for every season. But the singularity is the anchor. I dedicated the second chapter to Kurzweil and that idea. It's the anchor for the transhumanist movement, because whether you agree with it 100% or not, that vision of fusing human beings with machines, that vision of creating an AI God, that vision of directing evolution to the point that we hit a point of no return in which the technology is out of our hands, that is, in essence, a religious prophecy. And transhumanism is, in essence, a techno-religion.
Yeah, and you know, I've even heard Elon Musk talking about the alleged necessity of us merging with artificial intelligence if we want to stay relevant. I mean, he used almost that terminology right there. It's going to become so monumentally powerful that humans will become basically irrelevant if we don't merge with it and stay ahead of the curve. Terrifying prospect, if you ask me. One thing that I saw recently with Ray Kurzweil, and I've been studying the guy for a while, he's got these, in my opinion, just absolute delusions. He thinks we're going to, he was asked in his documentary, does God exist? And he responds, well, not yet. What? Is you're going to build God? That's interesting. But I heard him say in an interview recently, he was talking about where he gets these ideas from. And he says he kind of downloads them in his sleep while he's dreaming. These ideas come to him. And then he spends his waking hours implementing the ideas that he has received during his dreams. I suspect something really fishy is going on here. But we're down to just about 5 minutes left, Joe. And I want to ask you what is probably the most important question of all. How do we push back? Can we push back? I mean, you've got an appendix in your book, your 55-point plan to remain, to stay human. I mean, this is coming at us like a freight train. What do we need to know about all this? How do we stay human, assuming we choose to stay human, which I'm absolutely staying human?
Just for the audience so that they know that they're not daunted, 55-point plan is really a kind of a joke. You've all been to that conference where at the end of the talk, the guy's like, here's my 22-point plan to save the country. Here's my 13-point plan. This is the 55-point plan to save the world. It is really just looking at five different areas: personal choice, communal norms, institutional practices, legislation, political policy, and then, of course, the spiritual orientation of the individual and the society as a whole. And going through each of these, I lay out what I believe to be the proper path, but I make no pretense at being the authority on where the entirety of the human race should go. I'm simply really taking the momentum of the book as it leads you to lead you through all of these nightmarish visions that have been concocted about what the future can and should be. And I hope to inspire people to create or discover the futures that they would prefer as an alternative.
There's more to this interview with Joe Allen. To see all of it, go to thenewamerican.com, click on video, and then scroll down to How COVID Helped Suck Your Children Into Transhumanist Web.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
Joining me for the Taking Action segment is Research Associate Peter Rykowski. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Paul. It's great to be on.
Oh, yeah. I love having you here. And we get to work together. And the research and the work that you do is so valuable. So today we're going to be talking about taking action regarding the border crisis. So I'm sure there's lots of people who are super excited to hear what in the world they can do to help with the border crisis. What do you got?
Yes, so as you mentioned, we're going to talk about what's going on the southern border and what people can actually do to help stop the ridiculousness that's going on. But in short, migration and illegal migration is surging. It's actually worse now than it's ever been. So a few examples. So in Eagle Pass, Texas, that's been one of the worst spots lately.
And they declared an emergency last week, right?
Yeah, they did. And for good reason. I mean, each day, literally thousands of migrants come in just in a single day into the single city or small town in Texas.
What is that, like a town of like 28,000 or something?
Yeah.
And they got like 2,000 to 3,000 people coming in daily?
Daily.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible. And Border Patrol, they are so overwhelmed. They are releasing thousands of migrants into the country. So they catch these migrants, and then they instantly just release them into the country. They just don't have any capacity to detain them. And then, of course, the Biden administration doesn't want to detain them, and they're not giving them the proper resources.
I'd imagine these Border Patrol agents are also pretty demoralized.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you have a presidential administration that absolutely hates the work that they do, I mean, that is very demoralizing. We saw that with when the Biden administration perpetuated that hoax that these Border Patrol agents were whipping migrants, when in fact that was not at all what they were doing.
But yeah.
The administration attacked these people just for doing their jobs. And not only are they releasing thousands of illegals into the country, but once they are released into the country, these illegal aliens, they go off the radar. So Border Patrol has admitted that they've lost track of nearly 200,000 illegals that they've released into the country. And that's just what they've admitted. And overall, since Biden's taken office, over 8 million illegals have actually crossed into the country.
Yeah.
So out of a nation of 330 or so million people, 8 million just in the past 2 to 3 years have come in.
Are you
illegally
citing Border Patrol's numbers there? Because I believe it started in fiscal year 2020 and it just skyrocketed.
Right. Yeah, it is absolutely skyrocketed. And those are the ones that we know of. There are a lot more who come in that Border Patrol, they just don't catch.
Yeah, and they don't know about.
Yeah, and it's absolutely terrible. And, you know, unfortunately, the Biden administration, they have no intention of reversing course on illegal immigration. They are doubling down on these radical, ridiculous open border policies.
Yeah, and this has to be one of the most frustrating things that is happening in this country. I know, and so it's so important that people realize, is there something we can do? And I imagine it's limited as well, because we have an administration that some would even allege is actually creating this, even through connections in Central America, whatever. I don't know if there's any truth to that, but they're clearly not securing the border. So what in the world can people do when you have an administration that has no interest in it at all?
Yeah. Well, there's actually a lot that can be done both at the federal and state level. So first on the federal level, there's a lot that Congress can do. So most importantly, Congress needs to take action to secure the southern border, stop the flood of illegals coming in. And then second, Congress needs to end the various economic incentives that are driving or pulling these illegals into the country.
But that would mean getting it passed even the Senate. And what are the chances of anything getting past the Senate?
Well, right now, there's the whole situation with the budget. And right now, the Republicans in the House are in a relatively strong position in the sense that they can block any type of budget and say, you know, we want serious, actual reforms to our border policies, our immigration policies, and then in return, we'll pass a budget. That's what the Freedom Caucus has been pushing for.
Yeah.
So it's really up to the leadership in Congress, you know, especially Speaker McCarthy, the Republicans in the Senate to actually push forward with this. You know, right now it's mainly just the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
But they have leverage right now.
So what can viewers and listeners do? Are there specific legislators to pressure, including the Speaker of the House?
Right. Well, everybody needs to contact their U.S. representative and their U.S. senators. You know, each individual member of Congress matters, and we need everyone to be telling them, pushing them, make this a priority.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we see right now members of Congress, they're a lot more concerned about funding Ukraine and giving money to Ukraine than actually securing our border. So we need constituents to tell Congress that.
And kind of dive into that, because there are various ways that speak more to these legislators, right? It's like you have an email and they get lots of emails, and they even have rules about which emails they answer. But there could be, you know, email, phone calls. Maybe even if you live in that state, visiting them, would you encourage any of that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So emails are one thing, but if you actually go out of your way to give them a phone call, that's even more important. And
they'll get the message even better, right?
Right. And then even better than that is actually sending them physical mail, or actually going to their office or scheduling a meeting with either the legislator, you know, the representative or senator, and also their staff. The staff are very important as well. So everyone needs to do this and regularly. There's congressmen and senators, they have so many constituents, but very few actually go out of their way to even contact them.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, we heard last year, we heard a state senator from Kentucky, her name escapes me.
Adrienne Southworth.
Right. And she was making all these great points. Like, she was telling us how it works with state legislators and why we need to do what you just described. Go on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And state legislators have a role in this as well. It's not just Congress.
Oh, yes.
State legislators, there's so much they can do. They can end all these various economic incentives for the illegal aliens. So free tuition at the colleges and schools, welfare benefits, housing benefits, and so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And states like Texas, they can actually take action to secure the southern border. You know, right now we've been advancing these false legal theories that you know, only the federal government can do this. The federal government is supreme. States have no sovereignty. But the states can and should secure the border themselves, especially if the federal government is unwilling to actually secure the southern border.
What's your assessment? Do you think Texas is doing a good job? It seems to be a mixed bag. On the one hand, they're talking tough and they got buoys in the river and they're putting razor wire and whatnot, but is there more that they could have done?
There's a lot more they could do. For example, Texas should actually try deporting the illegals back into Mexico. Instead, they're transporting them into the interior of the country.
What a great point.
So, and when those migrants go into the interior, they stay in the country.
Yes. All right. So we got a minute 30 here. Did we lose any? What else can people do? So obviously contact. And we made that easy too. Before we finish, make sure that we let people know where and how they can, because we go to jbs.org. We got legislative alerts. They have numbers, phone numbers, and emails, and they can do it all, huh?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's all on jbs.org/alerts. And we have, for our alert, it's titled Stop Radical Mass Migration Policies. And we have a widget where people can very easily send emails, send phone calls, send video messages to the members of Congress. So it's a very convenient way of doing that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is no excuse for not contacting, you know, our congressmen, our legislators, and, you know, telling them to get serious on the border, take action. Don't just talk about it, but actually act on it.
Yeah.
And with the budget battle going on right now, this is
a perfect time, huh?
Right. It's a great opportunity. Congress has a lot of leverage to get this done.
We're going to be talking about the budget battle in tomorrow's episode. Peter, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for what you do. Say the website one more time before we get out of here.
It's jbs.org/alerts.
Thank you very much. Peter Rykowski, Research Associate for the John Birch Society. All right, folks. We'll be right back. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And join us tomorrow for another episode.